Thank you very much indeed, Robert. Now, there'll be an opportunity for you to ask Robert questions as we go on, but let's hear from our other panellists briefly now. Next to Robert is Simon Field from the Directorate for Education, and this time he is in the OECD. Next to Simon is Olaf Cram from Policy Network, and between Olaf and Chris is Goran Holten from the Caden Corporation. So could I invite Olaf, because we heard from Chris earlier today, could I invite Olaf to make an introductory statement, please?
For those who don't know me, I'm a German national who works for a think tank called Policy Network in Westminster, which is a think tank, or better, a network of individuals who try to look at best practice and trying to, in particular, focus on comparative analysis across a range of policy issues, ranging from social economics to European international questions. I'd just like to bring us back very quickly to what Chris mentioned this morning around the hot issues, because I think these are the questions where we need to think much harder about. It was about measuring success, the value for money, changing behavior, the priorities for action, and who pays. In what I would like to say, I just briefly touch on 2, 3, and 4 of them, because I think those are at the essence of where we need to make some progress. The most striking point this morning on substance, for me at least, was when Richard Lambert mentioned that the UK spent on average £90,000 for every child until it reached the age of 18. And this is by far, you know, much higher than the OECD average, but the outcome is less than satisfactory. If that is now recognised, I think we need to look very, very closely to what goes wrong when we invest so much money into every child and the outcome is not optimal. In the times of the budget crisis we are living, everyone looks, of course, now at where can we maximise return on investment. And there's been some very good research, for example, by the Lisbon Council in Brussels, on the quickest return, which seems to be around the raising individual skill level through primarily post-formal education training. This, you know, there's strong evidence, you know, a strong correlation between the turnaround time, you know, of post-formal education and the return on investment. Now, if that's recognised, the biggest obstacle to this is, of course, that those who are most likely to need this retraining are the least likely to get it. I think, you know, maybe Simon and others will deliver some facts later on, but those with tertiary education are 50% higher to receive or to take up retraining than those with secondary or below. We also heard from Robert, you know, what skill set is more likely to be needed in the future. But for me, above all, I think a stronger recognition is required for the fact that the most important skills is to learn and adapt to new, you know, environments and skills, either on the job or through learning provisions. I think we talk about lifelong learning. I think this concept of lifelong learning is not only unsuccessful so far, but also misconceptualized. I think we need to think harder about how can we create learning adaptation and learning capacities in order to equip our people for new and emerging challenges. Having said that, I think it needs to lead to an insight that knowledge must be ultimately decoupled from an understanding that a fact once learned is an automatic ticket to prosperity. What I mean with this is that people who have trained and learned for a particular job in their past, you know, can no longer or find themselves in a position where they no longer can rely on their particular knowledge and succeed in today's career and the job market. I think getting this recognition right, that increasingly, you know, we need to have the flexibility, the capacity to adapt to new situations, to learn, to relearn, is, I think, for me, the priority number one. Now, if you accept such a logic, I think there are a number of big obstacles for an agenda shaped around this priority. I just want to mention three and just talk about one in particular, and then I finish with that. One is about labour market polarisation. Franziska Freud in my working session talked a little bit about it, and tomorrow I think there's another session on it, so I don't want to go into it. Another one is gender inequalities and imbalances. Again, we have heard very little about it, but one of the biggest obstacles is certainly the level of inequalities, you know, in relation to gender, the recognition that the gender pay gap is still very high, the little policy initiatives which are put in place to tackle this problem, and what it coincides with a very interesting figure that in 2009, the first time in the EU at least, there are more men unemployed than women, showing you the importance of how we need to tackle this inequality of genders in the job markets. The area, the third area, where I'd like to speak very briefly about is early investment. There's very, very compelling research now on the importance of early childhood investment. The most impressive work I've come across is from Professor Frank Oberkleid, who's an Australian expert working for the Centre for Community Child Health, who shows very compellingly the connection between how early you challenge a child's brain and trying to invest into early stimulation in others, and the capacity of this child as it grows to adapt to new circumstances, to learn more and continuously throughout the lifetime. Now, if that's recognized, I think we need to think very hard about how, you know, we deal with the status of our nursery schools, the status for nursery teachers, you know, whether we offer the right pay, the right incentives for those people who occupy these extremely important professions in our community, in our societies, in order to get the basics for our children right when they progress through their lifetime. These three quick points I mentioned, labour market polarisation, early investment and gender imbalances, such an agenda, you know, is of course a tall order. And I'd like to finish by saying just this. It seems to me that the mechanical approach to fix each of the individual policy areas will quickly reach the limit if we don't recognise how much resistance there is in a variety of organisations, in the public, in government, to fundamentally change how we look at gender inequality, how we look at early investment, how we look at the polarisation of the labour market. I think the moral dimension of all this, and I think the American and Australian speaker implied or you know alluded a little bit around these issues, the moral dimension has become or is becoming much more important to put these issues on the top of our agenda in order to make real changes and real reform. Last but not least, I think here the European Union can really play an important role. I think the Europeanization of the British debate is not only in the UK's interest, but also a vital component of how we can make quick progress by benchmarking, by choosing intelligent indicators, by comparison, big crackers. Let's not forget that the biggest markets of the UK outside its own borders are still the single market. The relationship, the EU free movement of labour, has a huge impact on the labour market. A Europeanisation of the whole debate is, in my view, therefore, very welcome. So that's these political thoughts on how we need to change the agenda in the future. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Some really stimulating and some controversial stuff there, which I hope we'll have time to ask you some questions about. Let's move on to Goran Houghton, who is Chairman and CEO of the Kaydon Corporation. Goran, some points from you, please.
Thank you. There would be quite a few points to make, actually, but I will try to make a selection of things that I think were central to the work of the New Skills, New Jobs expert group that Robert presented to us. And I would do that by starting off with positioning some of the reflections that went into the New Skills, New Jobs expert group work by putting the whole thing into a broader global context, in which I'm wanting to reflect some of the work that I do with countries like India and China. And the main point that I'd like to make in that context is that, of course, when we talk about global labor markets, when we talk about the talent market, it is a relative comparison issue, and it is a relative competitive situation as well. Who attracts the right talent and who is most successful in using that? And I think traditionally, Europe obviously benchmarks itself quite often vis-a-vis the United States. And the point that I'd like to just make here now is that I don't think that that is an accurate reflection of the global situation anymore. I think Europe, of course, needs to benchmark itself against the United States, but it also needs to be much more aware of the need to benchmark itself against China and India and the relevant talent that is emerging and talent requirements that are emerging from those countries. And let me just elaborate on that a little bit more, because normally I think most of us would be considering China and India as almost like a bottomless source of labor, and that's not entirely true. I think this morning the Director General for the CBI actually made the point on the McKinsey study that had established certain qualitative deficiencies in that, and that eats very, very dramatically into the actual quantities. And the way that emerges is of course, if you have in a global context an engineer in India or in China who meets global quality expectations to the tune of 1 in 10 or 4 in 10, as it apparently is in India. Now, that in a national setting is perfect, might be perfectly okay, but we have to recognize that India and China, they're growing economically tremendously. And along with that growth, they're moving into higher levels of value added, on one hand, and they are creating business leaders in their own rights, companies that are hugely successful in the global context. And through that development, they are not only takers of low-cost jobs from the US or Europe, but they're also now increasingly so creators of very high-skilled jobs globally, and they are not. They're increasingly finding the skills shortage in that context, and are therefore looking at tapping the global talent market. So basically, the war for talent has, in my view, truly moved from rhetoric to reality. The second point, if you allow me a few more minutes, I would like to reflect on the issue and the challenge of lifelong learning. Now, lifelong learning is, of course, something that we all know about, we all talk about, but it was also adequately mentioned by Robert, and certainly included in the reflections of the New Skills, New Jobs expert group. But I'd like to just shed one particular angle on a specific challenge, which is very much a demographic challenge. According to estimates, about 83% of Europe's workforce of 2020 are already out there now. Now, because the majority of the workplace jobs, and particularly the majority of the jobs that are created, about estimated to 80% of the newly created jobs, will be in the small and medium-sized enterprise sector. Now, given the fact that a large part of the workforce is already out there, they're working for smaller companies who do not have necessarily the kinds of organized human resource development strategies and activities in place as large multinationals would have. These workers, these employees in that sector face an imminent danger of very rapid skill obsolescence at the same time as they are outside the reach of any formal or organized training activity. So therefore, that was a reflection of the, or one of the thoughts behind the debates and the reflections of the new skills, new jobs expert group, and certainly in part of the recommendations, thoughts are being put down in terms of how modern tools should be developed, and already those tools that are existing be made more broadly available for skills upgrading and skills retraining for these kinds of this part of the workforce for which the access isn't readily available. Now, it goes together with one last reflection, and that is the need for a much greater sense of individual responsibility for individuals' employability. It is the individuals that need to be inculcated with the awareness that for them to be employable in the future, they have to take an active individual role and initiative and responsibility for making sure that that happens. The policy side of it needs to make sure that those tools are then available for these individuals to carry out their responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Goran. Your final thought there reminds me of a time when I was working in northern Maine in the United States with dislocated workers. And I met this 52-year-old woman in this Career Advancement Center, as it was called. And I remember to this day one of the things she said to me, which was so true and just reinforces from an individual perspective what you've said from a system perspective. And she said she had worked in a paper mill all her life, and she'd been made redundant for the first time. And she came to this Career Advancement Centre where she was spending half the week for 6 months or so, 3 months perhaps. And she said, I used to think that my security lay in my job. And now that I've been here for 2 months, I realise that my security lies inside me. And it's all to do with my attitudes, my awareness, and my commitment to change my skills and therefore change my life. And she had it dead right. And how we can do what you've just said for me came alive that day in Bucksport, northern Maine. And we need to kind of somehow spread or wash that all across the continent of Europe. Thanks very much. Now let's hear finally for the moment from Simon Fields from the OECD. Simon?
Thank you. I've been listening today very carefully, and it's been a fascinating day, and culminating in the presentations of my colleagues here. And I've been listening with the ear of someone who spent the last 3 years really going around the world looking at vocational education and training systems, initial vocational education and training systems, and reviewing country systems as part of the OECD's Learning for Jobs exercise, and that's involved a lot of European countries, but also the United States, Mexico, Chile, Australia, Korea, China. So a very diverse set of countries. And so one of the questions I've been asking myself today is, what are the things that come out of that that resonate with the UK situation? And in fact, they're things that I would identify as resonating pretty well everywhere. Because despite the diversity, one finds that countries that are really extraordinarily diverse nevertheless face some of the same common problems. And I might just underline four of them. And the first I would mention is the issue of engaging employers. And this is really fundamental. You cannot really have a system of training and education that meets labour market needs if you don't engage the employers. And it's appropriate that I say that in the context of a UK CES conference, which, of course, the UK CES is itself an important and very promising initiative to get employers more engaged in the UK scene. Countries are enormously variable in how well they manage to engage employers. Culture matters, of course, and if you go to Germany, where I was last week, I mean, there is simply a law that employers have to be a member of the chamber, which then represents them. Size of country matters quite a lot. Social networks matter, so that if, for example, you go to Norway, where people kind of know each other, it works rather well. United States, it might seem to not work well because it's such a big country, but if you go to South Carolina, where I went a few months ago, you find it works rather well in a place that's roughly the same size and population as Norway, where everyone, again, sort of knows each other. I mean, England, obviously, is more of a challenge. But the institutions are also extremely important. You simply have to have some what are called peak institutions in Australia, like the UK CES, to try and draw employers in. The second issue, which is really, really important everywhere, is that the blending of learning on the job with more academic and school forms of learning is a really, really effective method of learning skills for work. It goes under a lot of different names. It might be called just the normal training regime that a surgeon has, for example. It might be called the dual system in Germany. It might be called an apprenticeship in Ireland or Australia. It might be called an internship associated with an associate degree in a community college in the United States. It might be called a sandwich course in the UK. But it's all the same principle, a structured mix of learning and workplace experience as a very powerful means of learning. It's powerful because the workplace is an extraordinarily effective place to learn both soft and hard skills, especially when buttressed by those underlying more theoretical skills that are best acquired in a more of a classroom environment. And that brings me naturally to my third point of what is important everywhere, and is not always recognized as being as important as indeed it is, which is basic skills of numeracy and literacy. I mean, we've heard a lot about them today, and quite rightly. And it's particularly important that they're emphasized as being intrinsic to workplace skills rather than as something is separate. And unfortunately, one still hears, even in developed countries, the idea of this guy is someone who's meant to work with his hands. He's not the academic type. It's typically a he. That you hear these things about. And that might have worked in the 19th century, but it certainly doesn't work in the 21st. There is a huge amount of evidence that the importance of numeracy and literacy is growing in nearly every job and pretty well every labour market. These are the skills that are required for further and higher education, to develop further learning, as well as to develop careers that, of course, change and shift over time. And that brings me again to my fourth point. Again, something which is important pretty well everywhere, and I have to say, badly done most places, which is the career counselling that needs to go with the increasingly complex life courses and life and career changes that we observe. I mean, at one level, it's a thing to celebrate all these horizontal and vertical moves we observe in people's careers. But my goodness, the navigation is complicated, and we do have to make sure that what we're seeing is not just a drunkard's walk. And too often, the business of careers guidance is marginalized, it's fragmented, it's too much rooted in psychological counseling and not sufficiently in the realities of the labor market. Those are the four challenges, if you like, and I've got some specific ideas about what one might do about them, but I'll leave those for now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you all. What an amazing, rich agenda there. In fact, enough for a whole day's conference itself, I suspect. Chris, a thought or two from you.
I didn't want to say too much, really, except I wanted to pick up on something that Simon said. I think we need to look at the experiment in the UK around employer engagement as not about the Commission, but actually about sectors and the Sector Skills Councils. For me, the issue here is the extent to which you can get deep inside industry engagement, be working with the leading employers in the sector, be actually capturing their insights and winning their commitment to drive a system that is much more employer responsive. And for me, and for countries like Canada, countries like Australia that are doing those sorts of things, I think that's the cornerstone of a successful system, because unless you get close to employers and actually win employers inside, bring employers inside the system to help shape it, then I think actually, advocacy from outside, which is typically what the Commission does, is simply insufficient. So I just wanted to address that issue.
Thank you very much. Now, we've got time for some of your points and questions, and the same as this morning, hold up your hands, we'll get a microphone to you. Please stand up if you're able to, and we can catch you on camera, and tell us who you are and where you come from. Right here at the front, please. Yep. Good afternoon.
My name's Graham Lane. I chair the Engineering Diploma Development Partnership. It's particularly to Simon Field, because I was very interested in the four points that he actually made. But in this country, I wondered whether the rest of Europe is actually more advanced than this. In this country, we have particularly politicians obsessed with the idea that there's academic education and there's vocational education, and they are done separately and they're aimed at separate people. Is the UK worse off than the rest of Europe in this, or does the rest of Europe have the same sort of dilemma, when in fact what you said about the four principles I think are absolutely right if you want a society which is going to compete in the global world?
Thank you. Let's just take another one or two and then we'll get a group of them answered. There's one right there in the middle. Good afternoon to you.
Jill Rubry, Manchester Business School. One point that seems to be missing from this discussion today seems to be age discrimination. We've heard a lot from the panel about how people have to be ready to be retrained, be flexible. But I suspect that the major barrier is the willingness of employers to invest in people who are beyond the age of 20. I think this is lies behind the gender pay gap and gender inequality, that women are written off at age 30. And yet we're moving towards a horizon of people working longer. And it's really critical that we actually change employers' attitudes. So it's not just a question of bringing employers in, it's also about changing employers' perceptions and changing their practices.
Thank you. Let's just take these two first. We won't have time for all of the panel to answer all of the questions, but the first one very specifically sent at Simon.
Yes, are we worse off in the UK? I don't know that we are. I mean, it is a common challenge right across Europe. If you want to look at a couple of countries where the status of vocational education and training might be a little bit better, you could look at Norway or Sweden. One reason for that is that although there is a vocational track in upper secondary education, there is no academic selection that determines that those who have a lower results are directed into the vocational track. That is in the context of a tracked system, of course. I mean, one other model which does occur to me, which I think is interesting in the UK context, would be the US model at its best. Now, the US model at its best in schools, in terms of vocational education, essentially involves doing what is commonly called career exploration, which at upper secondary level, the young people might spend perhaps 15 to 20% of their time in a career cluster. And that career cluster might be a cluster like health. Now, where it works at its best, and admittedly it's pretty rare in the at its best, that can be something that engages all of the cohort. In other words, the young person that is going to be a care assistant in a home for the elderly might have spent some time in that cluster, but also someone who is going to become a doctor. And in both cases, it gives them the blend of learning about medicine and health and hospitals, combined with an internship, so you can see what one of these institutions looks like, what it looks like, that is an extremely effective way of blending the vocational and academic side without stigma.
Thank you. Now, who'd like to pick up on the age issue? Please, yes.
Well, I'll give a quick stab at it. You're absolutely right. That's a great question, a great observation, and certainly the age discrimination has not escaped the debates that we had in the New Skills, New Jobs initiative or in the expert group. But what your question reminds us of is that perhaps we should be a little bit more active in keeping that on the surface and make sure that we observe the thing. A couple of observations that I'd like to make on that. First of all, in terms of age-related hiring behavior, it's been said that youth employment is. Higher than the national average, and that's anywhere in the world where you go. It's not only Europe, it's everywhere in the world. It's about two times, even three times the national average. And it basically boils down to first landing the first job difficulty that young people have because they don't have experience, and that basically works against them. We've done some surveys, employer surveys, with respect to the question has been whether they have retention strategies for older workers. Now, you could always can take two views on this. One of them is, well, there are actually employers that do reflect on this. How do they actually encourage older workers to stay longer? It is still low, but I think the most encouraging thing is, while it's still at a low level, it is increasing. So there is a slowly emerging awareness of the importance of doing that, and I'm putting the word importance particularly towards the background of the demographic reality that most countries will be dealing with. Now, does that then include motivational measures like recognition of acquired skills and training? In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. But I think that your question again opens up a huge field that needs to be developed, and we need to really look for how do we work on the the incentives and the motivational elements for people, irrespective of their age group, to continue to pursue their skills throughout their active working life. And secondly, how do we introduce the incentives and the motivations for the employers to better manage their talent throughout the working life of their workforce?
Thank you very much. Now, we've just time for one more. So who's going to catch my eye? The gentleman here, just below the camera. Good afternoon to you.
Could I challenge the deeply conservative view held by you, Mr. Chair, and Goran Hulton, when you said that it was fundamentally an individual responsibility to remain employable? And if we take the case of the British banks, wasn't it the CEOs who took massive risks and destroyed thousands of jobs? And wasn't it the shareholders of Cadbury who took the money and may destroy many jobs there? And is it your view, really, that it's the individual employees responsible for those major mistakes?
Let me respond to that one myself and then have others if they'd like to come into it. I didn't mean to connect these two together in any way. The example I quoted from Maine was not in any sense intended to blame the woman for losing her job in the woolen in the paper mill, but rather to recognise that left to its own devices, the institutions of that part of the United States were least likely to help her gain a new part to her life. But she, with the help of the advice and support and opportunity afforded by the state, was able to make better choices than she'd been able to make before and gain a kind of informed choice of the options facing her. I didn't mention the banks, so I'm not willing to have any of that view attributed to me. That's a debate for outside of here. But my sense is that in a very dynamic economy, and even, to be honest, in a not very dynamic economy, wouldn't one want people to be sufficiently informed and well advised and supported that they could make choices about their working life, which were the choices that they regarded as the best for themselves? That's what I really meant about, I didn't use the word, but I will use it now, about empowering and supporting individuals so that they can make really good choices rather than find themselves only getting into that job because it's the one that their parent did or the only one that's available in their town. So I'm absolutely up for creating the conditions in which the existing workforce and the potential workforce is able to become highly informed and make the very best choices. That's really where I stand. Any other panellists want to comment on that? Yes, Olaf?
Just one brief comment, because I think it also relates to the question just asked by the person over here. For me, it goes back to, you know, what is the UK's approach to what we call in Europe flexicurity. I think there is a mission for flexicurity now, which tries to combine clever ways of flexibility and security in the labour market. I think we all recognise, I think the majority of the people in the room here, that we will demand more flexibility from our workers in the future because of the changing international context, because of the changing labour markets, and other reasons. But at the same time, I think people will only accept this extra flexibility or this new demand for flexibility and adaptation if we get them something in return, some new forms of security which allow them to take risk, would allow them to take a retraining and, you know, horizontal changes across sectors and others. I think, you know, there in particular, there are a number of questions to be asked in this country about how can we provide some extra securities to worker without stifling the dynamic economy which we are seeing.
I'm going to give the last word on this to Robert, if he would want to pick it up.
Yes. I mean, the European Union, the European Commission, is also in favour of greater contributions from individuals, but it's a straw man to suggest that the responsibility lies only with the individual. It's very much always going to be public authorities, state, who have a role. The employers clearly have a very important role in providing the right skills. But individuals do have some role. And the difficulty is making sure that the three together come up with the optimum solution and how you provide the incentives that all three do it in the right way.
Thank you. Well, thank you for all your comments and your questions, and please join me in thanking the panel for their insights.